TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Gabe Brown, Brown's Ranch in North Dakota, Part 2. This is the last in a mini-series about protecting the food-bearing soils of the world from erosion and poisoning by agricultural chemicals. Industrial farming techniques, along with climate change, are causing the loss of 75 billion tons of topsoil each year. On May 4, 2020, Jesse Frost had a farmer-to-farmer conversation with Gabe Brown on regenerative agriculture. Jesse farms off-grid in Kentucky and hosts the No-Till Market Garden podcast. Gabe Brown's 5,000-acre ranch in North Dakota is now run by his son and his son's fiancée. Most of the Brown ranch is in crops and grazed by cattle, sheep, and hogs, with a small area in no-till vegetables. Here is Jesse Frost.
How big is the area where you're planting, like, tomatoes and peppers and the transplanted crops?
We have two permanent gardens. The one is approximately 100 feet by 150 feet, and another one is approximately about 40 feet by 30 feet. Those are our two permanent gardens where we will do the transplants.
And do you manage those any differently, or are you still just kind of doing the same cover crop, let it kill?
No, those are managed differently, and the reason being is many of the species in there, it takes our full growing season and there's not time to get a cover crop established. So what we do there is in the fall of the year, we take second cutting alfalfa hay and we cover the entire garden with that second cutting alfalfa hay. And what that does, that provides the same arbor, the same residue as would a cover crop. And then the earthworms and all the biology consume that hay in the spring of the year. Is all we do is part that old hay and put our transplant in there. It also inhibits weed growth and weeds from germinating, and it provides the food for all the biology. Works extremely well. We're also, of course, within the garden rotating the species, the varieties of vegetables that we're seeding from year to year.
Back to the 15 acres. So when those crops, after harvest of, say, the sweet corn and the beans, and are you going through and drilling in a cover crop then?
Yeah, typically, like if we grew sweet corn and pumpkins, cantaloupe, watermelons, it'll be too late in the year to get a cover crop, but we're going to bring our livestock onto them and let them glean from there. Once we've harvested everything we have wanted, we will let the livestock come in, whether it be the pigs or, and certainly the laying hens will go through there and they're going to eat any produce that we did not pick. Plus then, you know, they add to the nutrient cycling. And so the following year, I'll be able to just directly seed a cash grain crop into those areas.
Okay. So with the animal integration, one of the concerns that I've heard come up over the years, because we do some rotational grazing, but we don't often let them into the gardens, because one of the concerns we've had come up over the years is that they will compact the soil. So what's your sort of feeling about that?
Well, it's a function of time. And if you only have livestock on there for a very short time, they're not going to compact the soil. Also, the livestock, when they're on there, are grazing, for the most part, living plants. So that living plant cushions that soil and there's no damage. We run a lot of livestock. We have over 800 head of beef cattle, and there's times when we'll have groups of 400 to 500 grazing a very small area, but they're only on there for less than a day, and then they're moved. Well, you're not going to have any compaction as a result of that. It's management is the issue, not the livestock themselves.
I love, in some ways, like one of the things that often comes up on this podcast is we talk about the simplicity of these systems, and I don't know what I expect from a larger farm doing it on the kind of scale you're doing it from, but it shouldn't surprise me that it's also relatively simple.
Yeah.
And it really just comes down to what you were talking about earlier, just maximizing that photosynthetic activity.
You know, I tell people, and I write about it in my book, that I've become very proficient at being lazy. And if you observe nature, the hardest thing for man to do is realize that nature is self-organizing, self-regulating, self-healing. We, as a species, try to impose our will on nature. Why not work with her instead of against her? As in the case of me using winter to terminate my cover crops. Instead, most people, I got to go out there and spray glyphosate or some other product to kill the cover crop. No, let nature do it for you, you know? And that's, I think, one of the things that allows our ranch this size to be so successful is we're working with nature instead of against her.
Staff, how we talked a little bit about handpicking all those beans and that sweet corn. And then also, of course, you have all these, you know, 3,000 acres of pasture and 2,000 acres of crops. What does the staff look like?
Yeah. And that's what surprises people the most. Technically, I'm retired. I have other business interests right now that keep me pretty busy. This past year, I was away from home 282 days out of the year. And we've turned the ranch over to our son. So our son runs the operation along with his fiance. And then he did have one hired man. Now the hired man did quit the end of the year, which we knew was going to happen. And my son decided that he didn't think there was enough to hire another person. So our staff consists of me when I'm home, the little bit of time I am. My wife does the bookwork and helps out a bit with she cleans the eggs from the 1,400 land hens, and she helps out with some of the vegetable production. My son, who's 32 years old, and then his fiance works for us full time. That's the entire staff. As I said, 800 head of beef animals. We have several hundred sheep, several hundred hogs, 1,400 land hens, broilers, turkeys, plus the vegetables and the cash crops. But when you don't have to do all these other things, buying fertilizers, spraying herbicides, spraying pesticides, you know, giving your cattle vaccines and all these things, it frees you up enough time in order to stack enterprises. So we really don't have much staff. That's all there is.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to wrap my brain around the idea of having just a handful of people to do that. And one of the questions I think I have is, like, how do you get across 5,000 acres efficiently? What do you need to do that? Is it like a gator, a car?
Obviously we have a couple of pickup trucks, and we have two rangers because our land is not contiguous. In other words, it does not all touch. We're spread out about 10 miles. My son lives on one of our farmsteads that's 4 miles from the main farmstead where my wife and I live. And so he drives a pickup or a ranger back and forth. But realize when you're out there, say, for instance, moving cattle, and we do move our cattle every day during the growing season, it doesn't take you any more time to move 500 head as compared to moving 25 head. You open the gate, they're all going to go through because they know it's a fresh salad bar for the day. So it's just scale. The scale at which we do it does not add really any extra labor to that.
For somebody that's interested in this, what are some of the factors that go into, keeping livestock and being able to rotate them in and out of these crop areas? I'm thinking that fencing and water. Can you kind of talk about some of the factors there?
Sure. So fencing today is extremely easy with the technological advancements in electric fencing. So our entire 5,000 acre ranch is fenced with high tensile electric wire that holds the cattle in. Now, sheep take a little more fencing. You need several strands of high tensile wire, sometimes even more, to keep sheep in. Hogs are very easy. They only need one strand about a foot off the ground, and the hogs train very easily to electric fence. Our land hens are truly free range. They can go wherever they want, but they tend to stay next to what we call our egg mobiles, and they're guarded by livestock guard dogs. We use those with both the sheep and the laying hens in order to protect them from predators. As far as water, we have pipelines throughout the entire ranch that take water from wells and then pipe that water around the ranch. And at various locations, we have these watering sites set up so the livestock can come and water. During the winter, our livestock live on snow. They do just fine on snow during the winter, with the exception of the hogs and the poultry. Those we provide heated drinking water so the water doesn't freeze.
And then those are just going into tanks that are mobile. Like, can you describe what the, in terms of the water, like, I know that, yeah. You know, we worked on a rotational grazing. That's like where I apprenticed. We did some rotational grazing. We had to move the, we had to kind of dump our water container every day and then move it to the next paddock. Can you talk about how you've managed that?
We do not have portable water tanks. Instead, what we actually use is these large recycled industrial tires. They're 8 to 10 feet in diameter, and then they're set permanently at these locations. We probably have, I've never really added them all up, but probably 50 of these locations around the ranch. So within easy walking distance for the livestock. And we're moving our livestock so rapidly, we start near a watering point and then move away, and they just walk back for water, but they're only watering out of that particular point for maybe 3 days. And then they're on to the next point. So you don't have this compaction issue and this trailing issue that you often see. And those tires are just set permanently there. Now, we do this on leased land also. And if we ever lose the lease, you can easily pick them up and move them then. But it allows us then to not be burdened by that daily task of moving water.
Do you think having a diversity of animals is important?
What I tell people is, again, it's all about context. We have the five principles of soil health, and we've added a sixth one, that being context. What fits your context? You know, do you have wooded land? Well, then maybe hogs fit. How much browse do you have? If you have a lot of browse, then maybe goats fit. So each person's context is going to be different based on their environment. Now, what we like, the reason we have so much diversity is a number of reasons. We have a lot of acres of true grazing land, rangeland. That's ideally suited to ruminants, you know, cattle and sheep. Cattle and sheep consume different species. Sheep prefer the forbs, cattle prefer the grasses. So it makes sense to have them. We have grain, and with that grain, as I described earlier, we take out the weed seeds and broken kernels. Well, that's an opportunity. We have that feed source then to feed to the hogs and the laying hens. So they fit really well into our operation. The other thing that I think is very, very important is the more diversity you have resiliency in the marketplace, okay? Too many people, for instance, they only grow corn or soybeans. That's all they grow. Their whole livelihood is subject to the price of those two commodities. Well, you look at our operation and what we do, all the different pastured proteins and the eggs and the vegetables, we have many, many different income streams. This makes us very resilient economically. Plus, when you're selling to consumers, they would much rather prefer to shop at one location. You know, our consumers trust us. We have an open door policy on this ranch. Anyone can drive on this ranch at any time and look at anything. That builds trust with our customers. They want to buy from us. Well, they prefer to buy more goods. So that's another reason for us to stack enterprises.
I think that's a really important lesson. I also think, though, that it can be kind of hard to juggle all those different enterprises.
Right. And that again, comes down to each individual preference and the context. I have always just been one. I love a challenge. Our son is the same way. And make no mistake about it, we're extremely busy during the growing season. You know, we're doing a lot of things for a 6-month period of time, approximately. But that keeps it exciting to us. And are we overwhelmed by the workload? No, not at all. We just, you know, what has to be done. And again, it comes back to how do you stack enterprises so that they're complementary and not overburdensome. And then you need to make sure that they're profitable. Otherwise, they're not worth your time to do it. You know, a lot of individuals come and look at what we do and they just shake their head. There's no way I'd want to do that. That's way too much. We don't look at it that way. It's a lifestyle. We enjoy it. To each his own.
Right. I guess my brain was kind of going towards, like, do you all get a day off in the middle of the summer?
Yeah, and how I answer that is, yes, if we want, but, you know, the old adage, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. Now, during the summer, several times, my son and I like to go to Canada fishing. We book it in advance, and we're not moving the cattle every day if we're going to be gone. We just give them a larger area. So we go fishing for a week at a time. Several times, and things just slow down that week. We don't go to farmers markets that week, and we don't move cattle every day, you know, and make it easier for my wife and Paul's fiance to do the chores when we want. You know, people make it too complicated. It's about following the principles of soil health, and I don't care what scale you're at. Whether it's, you know, a flower pot on somebody's deck in New York City or 5,000-acre ranch in North Dakota, the principles are the same. And you follow the principles, you'll truly produce nutrient-dense food. We didn't even get into the nutrient-dense topic on the difference in nutritional quality in food. That's a whole other topic in and of itself.
Have you been able to measure that?
Yeah, we have. We actually have been measuring our pastured proteins for the fatty acid profile, omega-6s and 3s, and it's amazing what we're finding. Now, we didn't talk about some of the work that I'm doing with company Understanding Ag. We're actually involved in several large projects with General Mills where we're measuring the nutrient density of the grains and products being produced on regenerative soils versus those produced in more conventional type manners. And it's amazing what we're starting to see there. Other things we're seeing, we were involved in a project this past summer where we looked at over 20 different regenerative farms and ranches across North America, and then neighboring farms or ranches that were either organic or conventional. And we were looking at the difference. We grew the same variety of grains, the same vegetables, et cetera, on each of these farms. And then we measured, took those vegetables and grains and had them analyzed at a food grade lab for nutritional quality. And it's amazing the differences we're seeing. And one of the things your gardeners, listeners might be interested in is the difference between where there was tillage used and where it was not. It's pretty astounding. And for gardeners, they think, oh, they need to go in and till the garden. Well, that's the worst thing they can do for nutritional density of their foods. And you think you're producing healthy food in your garden, but if you've tilled the garden up, you've destroyed the ability of that garden and those plants to provide you with the nutrient profile that you really need. And that's just fascinating. And we're going to be hearing a lot more about that. We're involved in several studies that are working with that.
Yeah, and if somebody wanted to see those studies, or what, can you maybe give us a list of who's doing them and where to find them?
Well, right now, realize we are contracted by clients. And so that information is the property of the clients.
Okay.
And so until they release it, I'm not liberty to disclose that. But it's coming. There will be one book out before the end of the year that will have that study in it.
That's great. Gabe Brown, I really appreciate this conversation, and I really appreciate your work. The book, Dirt to Soil, is exceptional. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
That was North Dakota farmer Gabe Brown talking with Kentucky farmer Jesse Frost. Gabe Brown is now a pioneer of the soil health movement and has been named one of the 25 most influential agricultural leaders in the U.S. On November 10, 2020, Gabe Brown was interviewed by Dr. Sean Baker. The 17-minute conversation is posted on YouTube under Gabe Brown, Let's Fix Agriculture. Here's an excerpt.
I want to just at the outset say thank you for what you do for a living. I think, you know, you guys don't hear that enough, at least in my perspective. I mean, the people that feed us and do the hard work day in and day out is something I think a lot of people overlook and, you know, have no idea what kind of work goes into that. So just with that out of the way, can you just give us a little background history on yourself?
Sure. I grew up in the city of Bismarck, North Dakota, and I was not from a farm or ranch. But at an early age, I took a real interest in agriculture and married my high school sweetheart, who was from a farm. And after getting a couple of degrees in college, we came back to that farm and started farming and ranching in a very conventional way with her parents. And I'm one that I'm always trying to learn. And I had read about no-till, and I believe that was the way to go. So sold all my tillage equipment, went 100% no-till. And then what really changed my life was a series of natural disasters. 1995 through 98, we lost 3 years of crops to hailstorms and 1 year to drought. So I had no crop income for 4 years. And I had to learn, okay, if I'm going to survive farming and ranching, how am I going to get my soils productive without all these expensive inputs, because I just didn't have any money. And that really sent me on a path of learning how ecosystems function and how to produce nutrient-dense food. And it just was life-changing for us. We tell people, my wife and I do, that those 4 years were extremely difficult to go through, but absolutely the best thing that could have happened to us, because it really forced me to change the way I saw things. And instead of looking at the soil as a chemistry set, I needed to look at it as a living ecosystem. And how do I, just through my stewardship, enhance that ecosystem so that I can not only be profitable, but produce truly nutrient-dense foods?
You've got a book out called Dirt to Soil. And that's really what it, I mean, what is the difference between dirt and soil?
So most farmers, ranchers, they look at just it as just dirt. All it is a medium to hold a plant upright. But really, it's a dynamic living ecosystem in which all life on Earth depends. There's more microorganisms in a teaspoonful of healthy soil than there are people living on this planet. But yet, as farmers and ranchers, we don't think of that. And it's those microorganisms in running their life cycle that cycle the nutrients, that feed the plants, that feed the animals, that feed people. And without healthy soil, I don't care if we're eating lettuce or beef, without healthy soil, you're not going to have nutrient-dense foods. I wrote that book because I got asked to put down our story of how we took this very low productive dirt, and through just changing our stewardship, our practices, working with nature instead of against her, converted it to a very profitable living ecosystem that produces food high in nutrient density.
Not to put you on the spot, but you know, we've got these pushes now to stop eating meat. What are your thoughts on that, just in general?
So it's all about context. For instance, go into the Central Valley of California. It's like a desert. You know, they continuously till, plant many different crops, but those soils, I've spent time there, those soils are not living. Yet that's where the majority of produce is grown in our country. Well, what's the nutrient density of that produce? Man, it's almost better to eat cardboard than it is some of that stuff that's being produced, because there's absolutely no flavor. There's no taste. There's none of these phytonutrients, phenols, alkaloids, terpenes, none of that in soil that's not functioning properly. So what I tell people when they come at me, oh, we have to eat less meat. Well, how's that meat being raised? Do those animals live a life where they have this abundance of diversity in their diet? So because of that, they have all these phytonutrients in their meat, and we're humanely raising them in a way that's not only good for them and good for their health, but inevitably good for our health. Or do we keep them in a feedlot and only feed them, you know, a byproduct of, for instance, distiller's grain, byproduct of the ethanol industry, and straw? You know, on our own ranch, we do a lot of nutrient density testing and fatty acid profiles in the animal proteins that we raise here. And we now have omega 6-3 ratios in our meat, in our beef, averaging 1.2-1. Well, think of that. That's rivaling wild salmon for how high it is in omega-3s, plus all the other important fatty acids. And we need to look at that. We need to look at how are our crops and our animals grown and raised, and what's the soil that they're being grown and raised on like.
That was North Dakota farmer Gabe Brown, interviewed by Dr. Sean Baker. This concludes, for now, a mini-series on soil as a living being and the efforts to halt the loss of 75 billion tons of topsoil each year. That's according to the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.